October marks the start of Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the United States. It is estimated that over 313,000 new cases of invasive breast cancer will be diagnosed in men and women nationwide this year. So many families will find themselves facing this disease. Today, we meet one of my favorites. Welcome to Wondercast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness. Wondercast is made possible by the generous sponsorship of Texas Oncology. Texas Oncology, more victories, more breakthroughs, experts in cancer care. In this episode, we are rejoined by previous podcast guest, Taryn Schulke. This time, instead of sharing her expertise on all things death and dying, she rejoins us as a patient herself, sharing what life can look like right in the middle of breast cancer treatment. A wife, a mom, an employee, bravely sharing a glimpse into her every day for this month's client highlight. This is Taryn.
Hi, Julie. This is Taryn Schulke. I am a wife, a mom. I work from home, actually, which is really, really nice. I used to work in the medical field. I used to be a child life specialist, and I worked in palliative care for like 6 years doing grief support for a lot of families. And now I do something completely different. I'm doing marketing and graphic design and website building and things like that from home, which is really great because I get to be with my kids. I've got two boys. And then this year, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in March.
Let me clear my throat real quick. For my listeners, I will go ahead and disclose this. I've had a bad head cold, so my voice is going to sound very different. But I didn't want to miss an opportunity for us to visit. So it's hard to believe that was March. I feel like we had our conversation. I mean, I'm sure for you, it doesn't. It feels like it was March. You probably know every second of what that felt like. For me, it just, I cannot believe that, because you're so into your treatment now and so much has changed.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be intentional about starting October off with really highlighting different people that I know and love that are going through treatment. I feel like one of the things that we're lacking is just this real dialogue of what it looked like to be a mom, a wife, mm-hmm. kind of looking ahead at what treatment is. And I think what uniquely you have to offer is that you come at this with that background medical knowledge that I feel like a lot of maybe our other families that we support don't.
Sure.
Perhaps that was helpful, perhaps that was not. I'm sure it added some stress because you knew, and maybe you knew too much. I don't know. So I'd love to kind of dive into all of that. So why don't we first start with you, if you're comfortable sharing a little bit about your diagnosis and your treatment plan.
Sure. Yeah. And a lot has changed since I was on the podcast last. I mean, last time I was talking from the seat of somebody from the medical profession, sharing knowledge and educating in a way. And this time I'm the patient, which is so strange. It's a very strange thing to flip into that role. But I was diagnosed in March after I found a lump. So I'm the one that felt it first. And I felt it late January. I visited my OB-GYN in February. And she was like, oh my gosh, Taryn, this is huge. I was like, oh, great, good. So that immediately got me nervous. And then I started down a path at one medical center and I got my diagnosis with that system and basically, you know, did mammogram, ultrasound, and the radiologist who I'm so glad I had, she was lovely enough to give me a warning shot at that appointment. I did ask her point blank and I made her tell me.
Yes, because we know too much. Exactly. Having been on that side of it too. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, listen, I know you're not supposed to say anything. I know that's not your job, but I need to know if I need to start mentally preparing for some bad news. And she was kind enough to say, yeah, I think you should start preparing for the bad news. I was like, okay, great. Got it. And so then I did a biopsy and I got those results. And what I had at the beginning of my diagnosis was actually kind of a question mark in a lot of ways. The art of medicine has played a big role in my treatment plan. But I was diagnosed with invasive ductal carcinoma, and it was 4 centimeters at the beginning and in my right breast only. And at first they didn't find anything in the lymph nodes, but there was a nice twist there.
It's like a book you don't want to read. You're like, oh my gosh, what's coming?
I know. And what was so hard at the beginning is I didn't know that the results would just keep coming, that there were just test after test after test and scan after scan. I thought you get the diagnosis at the beginning and that's your diagnosis. No, it was like a spectrum. It just kept, the dominoes kept falling. And I wasn't mentally prepared for that. I didn't know that. Even working in the medical field, when I was introduced to people, to the children I was working with who were sick, it was after all of their diagnosis was complete, really. So I didn't know just how long it takes to get your full picture.
I know that now to a certain degree, but not really. Like, you're right. It's this, you're ready to plan with what you've been given. And then the information is constantly changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it changed from the beginning of my diagnosis to about a month later, after I got scans and more, you know, physical assessments and MRIs and so many things. It's just a lot at the beginning. And I didn't realize how much it would be. And now anytime I talk to someone else getting diagnosed with breast cancer, I just try to mentally prepare them for that, you know, it's going to be a lot of scans. You're going to be so sick of it by the time you've got your full diagnosis, and things can change. Even your treatment plan can change. Because for me, I didn't have any lymph node involvement. And then I actually switched over to another medical system. I'm with MD Anderson now. And the surgeon that I was connected with at the West Campus, she did a manual physical exam of my armpit and found something there. She found it.
Wow.
And I had already had 3 ultrasounds of my lymph nodes and they didn't find anything. And so she found it, which I feel like she should get some kind of award for. So I went back for my 4th ultrasound at that point to try to find it. And they had to call her during my ultrasound to ask where it was. Finally found it, did a biopsy, placed a clip so they wouldn't lose it again. It came back as abnormal epithelial cells, not carcinoma. So they had to decide what they were going to do with that information. Treat it like cancer or treat it like it could be non-cancerous. And because I'm so young, I was 34 in March when I was diagnosed, they decided to just play it safe and treat it like it was cancer. So technically I'm stage 2, but really it's stage 3 is how they're treating me. Because my treatment plan that they finally were able to give me after a long time of figuring out what was going on with me was chemo. And then I'm on a clinical trial of testing out radiation before surgery. So I'm doing radiation actually right now. I'm in the middle. And then I'll have my surgery in November.
How many rounds of chemo did you do?
A lot. too much. I know that some people do more than what I have actually, because I've talked to a lot of women, but I had 4 rounds of AC chemo. So the doxorubicin and Cytoxan. So that was, and that's dose dense. So I did it every other week.
Some of our listeners might know that as the Red Devil.
The Red Devil. Yeah. So I had the Red Devil plus Cytoxan at the same time. That's AC and it was dose dense. So it's every 2 weeks or every other week instead of once every 3 weeks. Did that 4 times. And then I had Taxol after that for 12 weeks. And I did that every week. And I actually was having some pretty intense side effects with the Taxol. So at the very end, my last 3 doses of Taxol, I had a 20% reduction in strength.
If you don't mind me asking, some of your big side effects with Taxol?
Yeah, that was actually really surprising for me, because at the beginning, obviously AC is supposed to be the worst. Mm-hmm. Like It's the Red Devil. And it was bad. It really was. I didn't have it as bad as other women, and I know that for a fact, but it was bad. And so I was told at the beginning of Taxol by my PA on my medical oncology team, it would be a breeze and that it shouldn't be much of anything. I shouldn't like really have any side effects as much, that maybe like fatigue would be a side effect, but no nausea or vomiting or anything like that. And so I got really excited. My expectations were pretty high. And then that was not my experience. It actually affected me pretty decently. I did not have vomiting for, actually, I didn't vomit through AC.
Which people don't know you, but I do. And I think that you should share, like, we all come into our life experiences with our own traumas and our own phobias.
Yeah.
And you truly have a phobia of vomiting.
Yeah. Yes, I do.
What's the official word of it? What's it called?
Emetophobia.
There we go.
So I actually, when I first got diagnosed, I called you and I was like, help me. What do I do? What should I expect? And you're like, get ready. You're going to be throwing up. And I said, are you sure? Do I have to? Is there any way I could not? Because I do have emetophobia. And that was one of my big anxieties before I started treatment, was I knew I was going to be puking and I was terrified of that. And you kind of giggled with me, I remember, and you're like, I'm so sorry, but you're going to have to get used to it. And I don't know if it was a sheer act of my mental will that I didn't.
It might have been. Because you might be the only person I've ever known to not throw up with that.
I know.
Were you nauseous?
Yes. Very nauseous.
I think that's worse than throwing up.
But some people think that, but not me. Well, here's the thing too. Let's back up to AC a little bit before I talk about the Taxol side effects. So with AC, I did everything in my absolute power to curb my nausea. And that meant that I went too far in the other direction. So I took Zofran and Compazine around the clock, not for 3 days, but for 5 days, just to make sure I would not throw up. And unfortunately, it wreaked havoc on my colon. That was bad. And so I actually had it too far in the other direction. And that was a big problem for me during AC chemo and Taxol at the beginning. Finally got it under control when I was like 3 weeks away from being done with chemo, but it was such an adventure. So yeah, with AC chemo, I had a lot of nausea, a lot of fatigue. And I think looking back on that, I think I have blocked out a lot of it mentally, if I'm being completely honest, because there were some side effects I was having that if I really sat down and thought about it, I'd forgotten some of it just because I think it had an emotional and mental block.
That's actually, I think, a blessing. I don't see that as a bad thing. I would, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to remember it at all. And the fact was, it was awful. Obviously, I lost my hair. You can't see me, but I'm still bald. I'm actually starting to grow my hair back now that I'm done with chemo.
I can see a shadow. Look at that little shadow you have.
I know. I'm getting an old man's, like, bald head.
I can't wait to see how it comes back. I want to know if it comes back curly or...
Yeah, that's literally everyone I talk to right now. That's what they say. They're like, what's it going to be like when it comes back? Is it going to be curly? Is it going to be straight? Is it going to be white? Is it going to be... I have dark brown hair. It's going to be dark brown. But again, I don't know.
People don't know that you have probably the thickest, most beautiful hair. And your hair grows so fast. And so I wonder...
Yeah.
How fast it's going to grow.
Yeah, I hope it grows fast. That'd be really nice.
I don't know. I will say this. Of all the families I work with, especially women facing any sort of cancer diagnosis, one of the biggest trigger stress points for them is not vomiting, but hair loss.
Yeah.
They just really like that visual sign of going through treatment is so hard for them to have to hold. And one thing that has been so refreshing for me, at least outwardly, is the ability that you have had to just rock your bald head. And it's just, and granted, it's been a Texas summer, right? And that is no joke. It's hot. But I think it's been really refreshing to see just how much you are just embracing. This is where I'm at. This is who I am. This is my head.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I don't know why it didn't bother me, but it didn't. And when I was losing my hair, that was the most painful part, was just the losing the hair. Because I did have hair down to my rear end. It was really long and really thick. What I did at the beginning was cut it off to my shoulders and donated it. I was really worried that they wouldn't take my hair if I was in chemo already and like cut my hair after I had gotten a dose of chemo. I was really worried about that. I don't know. I didn't even research that. I just had that assumption. But so I cut it off first to donate it. That's just something I've done in the past. And so I wanted to do it again. And then thought, well, if it's shorter, then it won't bother me as much when it falls out. But man, that process was brutal. And I think, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I didn't know that it would actually hurt when it fell out. And it did. It was very itchy, and the hair that would fall out, because my hair is so thick, it would just kind of stay in place, and then it would poke my scalp.
Ooh, that's not comfortable. No.
No, it felt like a million tiny needles poking my scalp. And so I got to the point where I was like, get this off my head now. I got to get it off. And so actually when I shaved my head, it was so great. I was so relieved that that part was over. I could just move forward and, you know, sleep at night, because it was waking me up, just the pins and needles feeling. I did have a wig. I do have a wig. I do have like the little caps that women wear. People were kind enough to gift me those things, but I didn't mind the way I looked bald. I still felt pretty. And I think a lot of women don't feel pretty anymore when they are bald. I don't know why I did, but I did. And I just kept it that way. And then I got used to it. And so it's just, then it felt weird to wear a hat, and it felt strange to, like, I tried the wig on finally. I waited until I was done with chemo to even try on the wig. But when I put it on, I was like, this is not my hair, and this doesn't look like me, and it doesn't feel like me. And so I just didn't like it. I didn't want to wear it. And it was, you're right, it was hot this summer. So
it was hot.
That kind of stuff's hot.
Do you feel like your kids have gotten used to bald you? I'm sure hair growing in is going to be different. I'm glad it's a gradual growth, because they'll kind of gradually get acclimated again.
Yeah, that was something. I have a 9-year-old son and a 4-year-old son. And at the beginning, before I lost my hair, my 9-year-old was really concerned about it. He was actually very self-conscious and was worried that it would be embarrassing for him, for me to be bald in public. And he, sweet boy, like the fact that he could even verbalize that to me was huge. And it allowed us to have a conversation about that. And I was able to prepare him mentally of, you know, maybe I won't like the way I look bald and I might want to wear a wig, but I might not want to wear a wig. And I'm going to have to decide that when the time comes, and we'll talk through it. He was just really nervous about it. And then after I was bald, I actually let him be part of the process of cutting my hair. He helped me cut off the first long lock of hair that I was going to donate. And then he helped my husband shave my head. And he had the choice to do that, and he wanted to. And like, he got used to me being bald. And so now he actually said a couple weeks ago, Mom, I don't want your hair to ever grow back. I like the way you look better without any hair. And we just...
He's gotten used to it. Yeah.
Yeah. We just laughed about it, because I reminded him, I was like, son, you were so nervous about me losing my hair and you were going to be embarrassed. And he's like, yeah, I don't know why I thought that. That was silly. And I like the way you look now. And I was like, well, you're just used to it. You'll get used to me have hair again. And he's like, yeah, I probably will. But
having spent so many years in the medical field, do you feel like that adequately prepared you for supporting your kids, or for kind of knowing what was coming ahead? Or do you feel like it almost in some ways made it more challenging because you were thinking of all the options and all the things to support?
I think it was both. I really do. In some ways, having a medical background did help me. And especially having a child life background, I do feel like I had a little bit of a leg up on preparing my children for what to expect and helping them through their emotions of it. But on the flip side of that, I worked in palliative care. So all that I really knew was the worst it could be. And so I assumed, this is so silly, but I assumed that when you get cancer and you're going through treatment, you will be hospitalized at some point. Because all I knew of the medical field were people who were hospitalized. And so it was a surprise to me that I could go through all of this and stay home the whole time and not be so terribly sick that I had to be hospitalized. So I think I was expecting the worst at the beginning and going through it. And that was something I was fearful of the whole time. I can't let my blood work get bad enough because I don't want to be hospitalized. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to be so dehydrated that I have to be hospitalized. I want to stay home. What I didn't realize is most people don't have to be hospitalized. They're just doing this like we've done it, you know, at home and going to the outpatient setting. That part was different and it skewed me quite a bit. And of course, I thought the worst case scenario in almost every single scenario there was to think about. I'm an overthinker. So it was worse in the evenings. It was worse at night. I would kind of, my brain would run and run and run. There were several nights when I would cry and my husband would have to hold me. And I would express like my worst fears because of the things that I'd seen and the things that I was worried about. And I mean, like, if we're just going to be completely honest, didn't want to die. I don't want to die. And I want to be here for my kids. So I know that my cancer wasn't so far along that that was a true worry, not something I actually had to worry about. But there's cancer in my body. It's something that crosses my mind. And then thinking forward to the future, that's a concern as well. Will I have recurrence? Will I get another type of cancer? Will it happen again in 5, 10, 15 years? I'm young. I've got a lot of life left to live. There's a lot more time for me to get cancer again. So just a lot of anxieties and things that came out worse at night. And I think my medical background, honestly, like for the worst side of this, contributed to that.
Absolutely. Because you know, you're especially considering the population, the fact that you have written a book on how to talk to your kids about dying. I mean, you are an expert in that field. And that was very much a part of your world. And so I think it would be very easy for me to have gone to that place too.
Yeah. Now, on the good side of that, I feel like I was able to advocate for myself really well. I had a very low tolerance for symptoms and side effects. I was like, okay, I know there's something out there that can help me with pain, with muscle pain, with joint pain, with nausea, with fatigue. Like, I just have to ask and advocate for myself, because if I don't, then they're not going to know what I need. And I don't think I would have been so forthcoming with my advocacy if I hadn't been in the medical field and known that, like, doctors are just people. They're just people like you and me that are experts in what they do. And I don't have to like be worried that they're going to think I'm dumb or pat me on the head. Oh, poor little pitiful Taryn. No, you just have to get through this. No, they want to help me. They're people like I am. So that helped a lot, I think, for the advocacy. And then on the child life side and the palliative care side, knowing how bad it could be, I feel like I was able to fire some warning shots with my kids in ways that I probably wouldn't have if I hadn't had the experiences I've had. And because of that, I do feel like my kids have coped really, really well with this process. And, you know, that me going through all of that and preparing them and supporting them through this was one part of that. And just a little shout out. The other part of that is I did go through wonders and worries, and my boys saw a child life specialist early on in my diagnosis. And whenever I had so much to think about and do, and I didn't want to play child life specialist with my own kids, I like let the professionals handle that. And that gave me room to breathe and to just take care of myself, knowing that my kids were being taken care of by a child life specialist. I didn't have to fill that shoe.
I know. I think that's important too. Just because you can, it doesn't mean you have to.
Right.
And I feel like that is something that maybe as healthcare providers, maybe just as moms or who we are, our role is to just do to make it as easy on everyone as possible. But really, you're not making it easy on you. And if you don't make it easy on yourself, the patient, the mom, how are you supposed to do all these other things? I don't know. I'm so proud that you were able to utilize that resource, especially having the skill set to do it yourself and still being able to say, nope, that's not my role in this right now. And I know I've talked to many physicians who have gone through treatment who, or like, I mean, think about it. OBGYNs get pregnant and they have babies just like the rest of the world. It's not like you're going to deliver your own baby. Hopefully not.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like it might happen, but hopefully not. And if you are pregnant, you're going to defer to your colleague of your choice or your friend or this professional who this is their life's work to. How do you feel like the kids are doing now?
Let me shout out Ashley Blackman because she was my child life specialist and she was fantastic and she didn't bat an eye at the fact that I was also a child life specialist. She just did her job and she was amazing and I needed that. And I actually relied on her quite a bit for exactly what you're talking about with my two kids being at different developmental stages. For my youngest son, he was just turned 4, but developmentally delayed by about a year and was actually just learning how to express himself verbally. So he didn't have a lot of things to say about my cancer because he didn't have a lot of things to say about anything. And so I was really worried. I didn't really know what he was thinking or how he was feeling because he couldn't really express it, even though he was on it. Like he knows what's going on. He was developmentally almost normal with like, say things like IQ and that kind of stuff, but unable to express himself. So I really relied on Ashley and her expertise and her assessment of him because my two boys are different in age, yes, but also different in development. We split them up whenever we did our sessions together. And so they each got 45 minutes instead of doing it together. And I think that was crucial for the boys to be able to have their own time to, you know, do what they needed to do. And most of what Ashley did with Samuel was play with him. As our child life colleagues know, is the best way to work with young kids. At one point, she did an expressive activity with him. It was about what your feelings were. And she had him pick out smiley faces. And all the ones he picked out were negative. They were all like, they were like afraid and sad and angry and like all these negative things. And my eyes were like dinner plate. Ooh, what's going on? He's such a happy kid. He laughs and smiles and, you know, he appears to be fine and normal and happy. And so when she brings this out, she's like, so here's what he picked up. I was like, oh my gosh. And I was like, well, Ashley, what do you think about this? You know, do you think that he's upset because of what's going on with cancer and all of the treatment or what? And she said, you know, his affect, which is how he is behaving, his affect doesn't match what he picked out. He was giggly and smiley when he was picking these things out. And so I'm not actually that concerned about this. She said he kept talking about the thunder whenever he was picking this out. And it clicked in my mind, like our kids are just kids. They have normal kid experiences and cancer is just a small part of what they're going through. There was a terrible thunderstorm the weekend before we saw Ashley and he was so scared. And he was processing that with her, and it had nothing to do with my cancer.
God, I love kids. Oh, I love kids so much.
But yeah, like if I hadn't have asked, and if Ashley hadn't have been so forthcoming, I would have probably internalized that.
And honestly, I think that that is another testament to what support like this can look like, because even though you're going through treatment for kids, sometimes cancer, even though it's this long process for you, and a thunderstorm, which is an acute event,
yeah,
they're on the same level. Same with like what was served in the cafeteria that day at school and, you know, who's best friends with who on the playground. Those all are of equal status.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that.
Right.
And so you might have all the right words to prepare them for cancer, but they're still having everyday feelings also about everyday life. And so if you can have an extra person to just be that touch point, that to me is huge, because even if they're just processing a thunderstorm, how great helping him express that and get those words out and come up with a safety plan. I mean, all the things.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, to answer your question, I mean, Samuel, my little one, he has been honestly such a delight through this whole process, because he's just treated me like mom. He doesn't see the cancer. Me going bald didn't faze him one bit. He kissed my bald head all the time. He would like pat it and grab it and like snuggle it, and it didn't matter to him. And what I realized recently is that he's been processing this the whole time, because after my chemo ended, he, on my last day of chemo, or the day after my last chemo, I was dropping him off, doing normal mom things, going through treatment. And he goes, "Mom, no chemo today. No more chemo." So he was paying attention this whole time, playing and being a normal kid. And now it's his favorite thing to say to me, "No more chemo, Mom. No more chemo," with this like giant smile on his face. So he gets it on his own little level and processed it and is now excited for me in like a very normal way. And just last night, I've got these little tiny hairs on my head. He was going to bed. My husband, Andrew, was putting him to bed. And he goes, "Mom, your hair grown back. Your hair grow back." And I'm like, "Yep." He goes, "Yay.
Sweet boy."
It's like, that's like, yeah, that's great. And my older son, David, he's 9, he's almost 10. And he's very intellectual. And so this entire process, lots of questions, lots of wanting to know the science, wanting to know how I am handling my side effects, checking in on me, being helpful. Like, for me, my focus with him has really just been trying to encourage him to stay a child and not grow up too fast in this process, but also letting him, you know, have those moments of feeling proud and helpful. And
that's why I love that you had him help with your hair and
like giving him the choices, but
yes,
also encouraging him, like, "Buddy, thank you, but you don't have to worry about me. Dad's helping me. I've got it under control. I've got a bunch of doctors. I'll be okay. Like, you can go play Legos." You know, they're both doing really well, and I'm very relieved about that.
So how many more radiation treatments do you have left?
I'm exactly halfway through, and I've got 5 weeks total. So I've got 2.5 weeks left, and then surgery.
Then surgery. And your surgery will be a double mastectomy, or are you doing a single?
I'm going single. So that was a really difficult decision to make, actually, because at the beginning of this, I was like, "Cut them off. I don't need them. Like, just get them away. I don't want either of them, even if I only have cancer in one side." And after that initial instinct, I was able to process and educate myself and talk to my doctor extensively about prognosis of all the different paths that I could take surgically. And she told me, for my specific cancer and what I have going on, that the outcomes would be the exact same if I did a single mastectomy versus a double. I decided to do the single because it was less surgical risk. That was really the only thing that tipped me over. Yeah, I met with my plastic surgeon, and he thought I was a great candidate for a deep flap procedure and explained it to me in depth. I was blown away. I'm thrilled to have that. I did not want an implant. That was something that I just didn't want, the maintenance of that. I didn't want to have to come back and have it redone, because I'm so young, it would have to be redone at a certain point. So to have that as an option, to have a plastic surgeon on my team that is competent in that surgery, I feel very lucky and very thankful. Nervous about the recovery of it. It's going to be a whole long recovery, but I think it will be worth it in the end.
Yeah, I think so too. You've done some hard work already, so
yeah,
you'll get there. One last thing that I really do want to touch on, because I, I hear this a lot from the women that I support through Wonders and Worries. There's not tons out there about what that looks like with doing treatment and working or not working. And I know that's a decision that you kind of were feeling the heaviness in the beginning. How has that played out?
Yeah, I was very nervous about that at the beginning. And at the beginning was very nervous about being sick and working. And I do work from home, which, wow, I didn't realize how lucky I am to have the situation I have, because I could not imagine having to drive into work and working in an office or at a hospital while going through this. I was concerned about feeling sick while working. Would I be able to work and do as good of a job as I hold my standards to? And also the fact that I'm a contractor now played a huge part in this, because I'm not a salaried worker. If I'm not working, I'm not making money. And that was extremely stressful for me, not knowing how things would turn out. And how it's actually turned out for me is I've basically done half time of what I used to do. So, you know, having to go to appointments, it takes up a lot of your time. Feeling not well, feeling sick takes you away. And it's been about half hourly what I used to do. Another problem of contracting is you don't have FMLA. So I couldn't do FMLA and then use PTO and just get paid. I had to keep going. And I did keep going. I've worked consistently part-time throughout all of treatment.
Which is amazing. That is hard work in itself.
Yeah, it really stretched me. And luckily, the person I'm contracting with was very flexible with me and understood that my hours might be a little strange, or there might be days that I'm not actually working, but there are days that I will, and helping me peel back some of the things that I was doing so that I would feel less pressure in deadlines and things like that. So I think what's helped me throughout this is just being honest with people about how I'm feeling. And this is through all aspects of my life, not just work. Just being honest. You know, I feel really bad today. I can't do anything today. And then allowing myself the time to lay down. Because as a working mom and wife and a daughter, actually my dad had cancer last year. And so I was also, you know, housing him for a little while throughout my treatment while he was getting his surgery for cancer. It was a lot. You know, his tumor removal was the day before I had a dose of AC chemo, if that puts it in perspective. And it's been a lot. And so to be honest about myself and how I'm feeling emotionally as well as physically has been the key. For me, it's not been any single thing that has been impactful. I think the thing for me personally that has been the most helpful are the friends and family that I have surrounding me and how supportive they are. You know, with cancer, when you lose your hair, and I was bald, and so I think it was more obvious to people in public. I had a lot of experiences of people stopping me in public and inquiring about what was going on. And I had a lot of people feel that they had a right to know my own medical experience just because I was bald. And I had people interrupt me while I was having lunch with friends and just having a good time, stopping my conversation with people to ask if they could pray for me there in public. And it's just been a very interesting experience. And I am a prayerful person. That's a big part of my life. But to see what it's like for your diagnosis to be so outwardly apparent and to have people interject themselves was strange. It was a strange experience. And I feel like I've learned a lot from that. And, you know, as well-intentioned and kind as people are and intending to be, like, I kind of just want to eat my burger with my buddy and, you know, tell stories and laugh and feel normal and not feel like I have cancer. And then to be reminded in the middle of that it's difficult. So I think the family and friends that got that and just treated me like Taryn, and, you know, I'm more than my cancer diagnosis. I'm still all the other things I was. that has greatly changed my perspective and given me the support I needed. You know, throughout all of the nastiness and pain of cancer and treatment, there's been a lot of beauty. People have risen to the occasion and shown me a lot of grace, supported me in ways that I never thought I needed, and it's gotten me through it. There are people that I didn't even imagine would show up for me that have, and it's an interesting spot to be put in, to be needing people so badly for your own survival. It takes humility to do that, and that's something I've had to grow in, and a lot of joy and still a lot of silliness and me being myself as a person. And I don't feel like all of my humanity has been stripped away by cancer and treatment. Certainly, to an extent, that's true, becoming a patient, but I've been able to hold on to a lot of it. And that's what I try to cling to.
Thank you for tuning in to our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.